is another 9 a.m. It's May. Is it May? June. It's June 5th.
Dana,
oh, my God.
Get with it.
Well, at least
here.
I didn't say it was October like I did that one. Can you believe it? June 5th, people.
Good morning, Atlanta. Welcome to June.
Where does the time go? June 5th. Holy cannoli. All right. You're listening to Good Morning Atlanta, sponsored by World Trade Center Atlanta on Business Radio X, a proud 2013 member of Central Atlanta Progress. You can learn more about Central Atlanta Progress at atlantadowntown.com. I'm the very confused Dana Barrett.
And I'm Elizabeth Gordon, here to keep you straight.
Thank you so much for that.
And in the studio today, we've got LaGalia Appleby.
Hello.
Welcome.
Hello. Hi.
Welcome to the show, LaGalia. We're so happy to have you here. We are going to do our normal rundown of the headlines and what's going on here in town. And then we're going to talk to LaGalia about something that everybody should probably be thinking about if you own property, either for your, you know, home or your business. And that is how to save some money on your property taxes. So look forward to that in the probably second half of the hour. Property taxes is one of those things that and LaGalia and I had lunch a week or so ago, and I was saying, like, I think I thought about them for 2 seconds when I bought my house. And then when the bill comes, especially if, you know, most people have a mortgage, and so you get this property tax bill that your mortgage company then pays. And I used to get them when I owned a home, and I would look at the bill and I would be so confused. What do I do with this?
Well, now, the beauty of it is that the county sends out an annual assessment notice every year prior to you getting your bill, so you have an estimate of what you'll be paying for 4 or 5 months down the road.
Okay.
So that's the beauty of
the
new system.
People who pay attention, like LaGalia, are people we all need to know, because people like me who are head in the sand, kind of, I don't want to think about it. We need people like you to keep us on the straight and narrow. So hold your thoughts on that, because we're going to get to that. But I know that's something everybody listening will want to know about, because...
Well, it's one of those things that you take for granted, like, you know, death and taxes.
Right.
You've got to pay. But, LaGalia actually has some very, you know, like an insider scoop on the whole thing. Because I think most people just figure, well, you got to pay what you got to pay, and, like, that's it. That's the end.
And that's
of the
not
game.
True. You don't always have to pay what you have to pay.
And that's what I like to hear.
Right. Well, and the other thing is, you know, we had somebody on one of our shows yesterday here at the station that was talking about business coaching. So I'm going to go off on a tangent a little bit, because that's what I do. You know, business coaching is something that's only been around, I was informed yesterday, since 1993. So it's not an old profession. Like, take doctors. They've been around since the beginning of time. We all know we need to go to the doctor when something hurts, right? But business coaching is can feel like a luxury. And one of the things that we were sort of talking about in that show was that the idea that you feel like you should know everything. When you're a smart person, right, you feel like you should know everything and you should be able to do everything for yourself. So if you are in business and you are receiving bills, that you should be able to, especially small business, you know, 1 or 2 or 10 people, you should be able to handle it and manage it and do your own books and do your own marketing and do your own branding and whatever it is. But I think the people who really have it figured out understand that bringing in experts on any topic, you know, if your expertise is branding, then you probably need an accountant to come help you do your accounting, to help you run your branding business, your marketing business, right?
Exactly.
And everybody, I feel like, probably needs LaGalia, because how many people can say they're a property tax expert, you know?
I equate it to getting my hair done. I can do my own hair, but when I go to the salon, they do it much, much better.
Yeah, good analogy. I knew you'd be great on the radio. All right, let's cover some headlines, and then we'll get back to property taxes, because I could probably talk about this stuff for, you know, hours. Let's start with cars, Elizabeth, because we both had some car trouble. Our cars needed some love. So Auto Trader did a study that shows that people have relationships with their cars similar to those relationships that they have with other people.
This is very true. I mean, you hear people like talk about their car as if, you know, it's their pet, as if it's a member of their family. A lot of people, not so much here, but, you know, in the Midwest, it's really big, the whole naming your car thing.
Oh, no, no. It happens here, too. My sister named her car.
Does your car have a name, Dana?
My car had a name for about a second, because when I got it, my daughter was like, we have to name it. My daughter's car had a name. My daughter had a car in high school, like a used piece of junk, like it was a bajillion year old Honda, and it was called, I think it was called, no, my sister's car, I think, was Frank. I forget what my daughter's was, something similar. But yes, I mean, people name their cars, people, you know, and they talk about how breaking up with your car is very hard. Like deciding to get a new car is difficult for people because they love their current car.
Well, and here in Atlanta, where if you do the commute kind of thing, you might spend more time in your car than
with your husband.
With your, right.
Oh, you actually do. Like 2 hours to and from work, you do spend more time in your car.
Awake, then, right, you're...
Right.
Your
and you
spouse.
And you feed it and you care for it, you know, and you talk to it, you know, and it supports you in your times of stress when you're late to get somewhere and all those kinds of things. Right. And it's sort of like clothes in a way, too, because it's sort of you pick out your car, it sort of establishes your personality. Like, let's talk about Elizabeth's car and my car and what they say about us. Right. Elizabeth drives a snazzy red sports car.
It's pretty cool.
It's very cool. Because she is like a snazzy, like sportster, hipster, like speed loving woman, right?
Right. And it's fast.
It's fast. You know,
very fast.
It's like, it's like no nonsense. You know, it's like she's going to take no prisoners. She's out there like kicking butt and taking names, right? And then I drive a beige convertible Beetle, which is like sunny and happy
it's
and silly
cute.
And cutesy and yeah. And goofy and sarcastic and knuckleheaded, and that's me. So there you go. LaGalia, do you care to share what you drive?
I drive an Altima, but I picked that car because of for family reasons.
Okay, I did that too at one point in my life.
So I don't
so
like that
it doesn't
car.
Define you.
It does not define me at all.
Okay.
So when I look at that car, I'm thinking of a CLS 550. That's
yeah,
what I
okay,
need.
Okay, that would define you.
That would define
okay,
me.
Okay, good. So it's funny because, you know, when you talk about breaking up with your car, I'm sure a lot of people could call in and talk about, you know, how much they love their cars because people just do. But so now I'm driving this Beetle. This is my second Beetle. And I swear that I never was going to be the person that did that. Like, I was the kind of person that changed my haircut every 6 months. And my car was the same. Well, not every 6 months. This is only like the fourth car of my life. But that I was determined that I was going to try something different, a different color, a different brand, whatever, so I could experience a bunch of different cars. But then I had my first Beetle, and it defined me. So, but here's what happens to me. And I hate to admit that this happens because it's happened twice now. After 5, 6, 7 years of having my car, I get in an accident. And then I feel like my car has betrayed me.
No, that's just a signal for a new car. New Beetle.
Right. But that's the thing. Like,
it's like now there's a rift in the relationship.
Right.
You guys have been besties.
Right.
You know, there for each other. And
right.
Now suddenly there was this.
He betrayed me. He cheated on me. He did something I wasn't. Of course, it was me
pushing the car
that forgot to look.
Right.
Before the
damn it! It's not the car's fault. But here's what happens. This is like I hate that I'm even going to say this out loud. But it's like putting someone in a nursing home and forgetting they're there. It's like he went in the shop and now he's not the same. You know, like he came out and he's not the same, and I'm just kind of not happy with him. So, and by the way, it wasn't until this very minute that I realized my car was a male.
We do absolutely literally personify them. I mean, I was at the dealership earlier this week, and it was funny because I originally pulled into the wrong place. You know, they've got like where the used cars are and where the new cars are. And the guy that told me I was in the wrong place was actually a sales guy for new cars.
Right.
And he was like, well, let me show you where it is. Actually, why don't you drive me down there? So he gets in the passenger seat, and as we're driving to the service entrance, he's like, you know, have you ever thought about upgrading to a new car? And he's trying to, you know, sell me another car.
And you're like, no, I love this one.
But yeah, once she got fixed up with all of her new parts and they gave her a nice bath, and I drove off the lot feeling like I had a brand new car.
Yeah, and I feel like mine is sort of like he's just never going to be the same. Like maybe he was like my young son, and now he's like turned into a 20-year-old snarly, like snotty.
No, he's just divorcing you. That's all.
Well, he probably feels like you betrayed him.
I'm sure that is. I let him get hurt.
I mean, the car was just as traumatic for the car as it was for your
broken wrist. So now I'm looking at new cars because, I mean, also, I mean, in fairness to my poor car, who doesn't really have a name, and me, I actually need a different kind of car because the type of work I do has changed a little bit, and I tow around a lot more stuff. So a convertible Beetle is not really the best for towing things around. But here's what happened. This happened after I saw you last, LaGalia. I went to a couple different dealers. I looked at like a Ford Escape, and then I went to the VW dealer because I couldn't help myself. Okay. And I looked at some of their smaller SUVs, and I looked at the new Beetle. And guess which one I loved?
The new Beetle.
Yeah, that's right. The new Beetle. It's so awesome. And really, the non-convertible model has a fair amount of towing storage space. Look at me trying to justify it. It's really cute. Easy to drive.
See, all right. It is, I mean, very much, I think, an emotional decision. And it oftentimes takes that kind of a traumatic or some kind of a pivotal moment for you to decide to make that shift. It's more than just a practical decision, right. I think, is the whole point of the Auto Trader survey, which is very interesting.
It really is. And it's an interesting challenge for car dealers because they have to sort of convince people to let their current relationship go
right. And
fall in love with something new. You know, and while we're on the subject, I have to say, in looking for a new car, as somebody who is, and this is another story that I think I have in my notes here for today, so I'm going to segue into it. But the next thing that happens is you have to apply for credit to buy your new car, unless you have cash, which most people don't, right? So,
right.
So the next thing that happens to me, because I'm a freelancer and I'm sort of self-employed, and I'm not really part-time at this point. I work quite a bit, but I start thinking, well, I wonder if I can get approved for a loan. I mean, I'm supporting myself. I'm doing okay, but I'm certainly not raking it in, and I don't have a traditional job where I can just
pay stubs of
right, where I can just write down a dollar amount that I make per year because I don't really know. And so then I start worrying about my credit. So then what happens for me, credit is like, you know, you can go online and get your credit score, right?
Right.
I'm afraid.
You're afraid?
I'm afraid.
Oh, don't be. It's easy.
I know, but I'm afraid to know. It's like back in the day, like when they first started, I can't believe I'm going to say this out loud, but when they first started doing HIV testing, I was like, in the 80s, you know, I was like, I don't really want to know. Like,
no?
I don't want to know. Now, granted, that's 20 years ago. And since then, I have gotten tested for various reasons. Like, they test you when you're pregnant now. So I got tested before I had my daughter. And, you know, I think I've gotten tested multiple times now. But at first, when I started thinking about it, it was sort of like, well, I wasn't always that responsible in college and whatever. I don't really want to know. If I'm in trouble, I think I just want to, like I said, put my head in the sand and just not really know. And I almost feel the same way about my credit score, which is, by the way, everyone, I am not
HIV
positive.
Because it's one of those things that you feel like at that, there's not much you can do about it.
Right.
And so your credit's bad.
Right. Like, then you're just going to die. And why do you want to know? And your credit score, like, I think it's okay, but I don't really know. I mean, I had a business at one point. I had a little bit of trouble when I closed up a particular business. That was now 5 years ago. I think I'm back to probably okay, but
you're probably good to go. Do you have credit cards?
Yes, I have credit cards, and they send me new requests.
Well, that's a good sign.
Yeah.
You know, when you're not getting the offers anymore,
right.
They've put you on the
no-fly list.
Right. So if you have credit cards, you can use those to buy a new car.
Right. So
take
I have
out the cash.
I have options, yeah. But I'm just something about getting my actual credit score and knowing is just making me nervous. But you know what? I'm going to do it, and I'm going to report back on this show about the experience.
You're going to report your credit?
Well, we'll see. Here's what I'll tell you. They say 700 and over is good, right?
Full disclosure here. Dana is so
why not?
Open with everything.
I like to share.
I love it.
But so they say 700 and over is good. Isn't that right?
Excellent. It is
750
good.
Is like amazing. Anything over 700 is really good, right? Under 700 is bad? Is that?
No, it's not bad.
No,
it's
mean, under 500 is bad.
Okay, so here's what I'll do. When
under
I after
400
I,
is bad.
I'm going to set a goal for myself. I'm going to do it. And what I'll do is I'll just tell you if it's really bad.
Do you want to take bets? We should do like a over-under on
yeah.
Dana's credit.
So I'm gonna
I'll
just
open up the betting pool. Contact me at the studio if you're interested.
That's Elizabeth at businessradiox.com. I'm going to here's what I'll do. I'll tell you when I come back on the air next week, bold statement, because that means I have to get up my guts to do it between now and next week. I'll tell you if it's really bad, okay, or really good. Three categories. Fair enough?
Fair enough.
Okay, done. All right, moving on. Speaking of people who are, you know, freelancing, self-employed, small business employed, whatever, some good news in the small business sector, which is that small businesses are adding jobs. But the interesting thing to note about this is, you know, another survey that was done, this one by Intuit Payroll. They found that that small companies are adding jobs. In fact, businesses with fewer than 20 employees created 35,000 jobs in May in this country. And that's the most jobs added since January 2012. But it's part-time, which is interesting.
Well, predictable. I think a lot of people kind of saw this coming with the Obamacare being implemented and businesses taking a look at benefits and what they were going to have to provide a full-time staff versus small part-time. And also, I think even though we are in the midst of economic recovery, it's still sort of tepid. It's like we kind of are recovering, but nobody quite trusts it completely yet. So I think there's a lot of companies that they're growing. They need people. There's more work. There's more business. But committing to a full-time employee is much more of a, you know, economic commitment for a small company than just adding a part-timer.
Right. Well, and I mean, I've owned small companies and used contract and part-time employees mostly when I had small businesses because there is less of a commitment as an owner. I mean, even now with some of my freelance stuff, I will hire people occasionally for day work. You know, like for this, we're doing a video shoot in a couple of weeks with my production company. And, you know, I have some younger people coming to help me that are, you know, hourly and they're just paid for the day. I just call them when I need them. And if they're available, I pay them. They're not on my payroll full time because there's no way I could afford that. So I think it is really common. It's a good way to grow your business using part-time and contract help. And frankly, it's good for people who are looking for work, who haven't found anything yet. At least they can find some work here and there.
You know, but I also think that the mindset of people that is changing. Instead of going to work full time, people are now looking at part time opportunities because of the economy. It opened up other doors for them to look at their life and lifestyle.
Yes.
I have a girlfriend that was recently released from her job, and she's happy. She was happy.
You know what? I find that's true for most people. I also have myself have been, quote, I like that term, released from jobs. And
it does feel like that.
Freedom, released, that's what that is.
Freed from jobs.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. And you know, my boyfriend recently changed jobs, and you do find that you are, I think sometimes there's, you know, that silver lining is really true. It's better in the long run. If it wasn't meant to be, it wasn't meant to be. If it wasn't a good fit for the company, it really wasn't a good fit for you either, you know? And you're right. I think the way the economy is, a lot of people are looking at part-time opportunities, looking at multiple opportunities. And frankly, I think that's a smarter place to be anyway, because you can't get released from all of your work if all of your eggs aren't in one basket. You know, so if you have a couple different part-time jobs or you freelance here and there and you lose one of those, you still have the other one or two or three, right?
Yeah, it's just like the Jamaicans, you know, multiple streams of income.
Yes.
Lots and lots of jobs.
And so you do what you know, I mean, none of us want to work 80 hours a week if we can avoid it. But at the same time, maybe some people
some
do.
Some people
no,
do.
No one wants to work 80 hours a week.
I don't want to work 80 hours a week. I want to get paid.
Apparently,
like
I'm the only workaholic in the room.
Yeah, well, you enjoy that. I will not be joining you. I want to get paid like I'm working 80 hours a week, but I really want to work about 8. Can we work that out? Anyone? No? All right. Well, but I do think it's interesting because I think also here's another thing. I think as we age, that becomes more critical because when you get released, I'm going to use that from now on, LaGalia, and I'll credit you when I do. When you get released from a job and you're older, let's say above 40, above 50, certainly above 60 for sure, it's that much harder to get hired into something new because you were probably making more money than your younger counterparts. And people, even if you weren't, the hiring managers look at you and they say, oh, he's going to want, you know, too much money, or he's too experienced. We want to bring someone in who's younger. So looking at entrepreneurial opportunities and looking at real estate investing and looking at, part-time opportunities are all things I think you have to start doing when you're a little bit older.
Oh yeah, most definitely.
It's a whole shift, I think. Also, you know, there's a commercial on TV right now about how old people are, how knowing the oldest person you've known is how old, and they show like a graph of people knowing people who've lived to 100 and over. And it's a commercial for something to do with saving for your retirement. But it is so interesting because we are living so much longer now. And what did the retirement age used to be, 55?
Really?
I think a long time ago it did. Honestly.
No. Not in this country.
I don't think so. Not ever in this country.
65? 60? Yeah.
Did you grow up in Greece?
No. I really think I honestly think like, because you AARP,
right.
You get stuff from AARP at age 50, I think.
Yep. They're already calling you a retired person at that.
Correct. But here's the thing. LaGalia is like, no, I promise you.
And how old do you have to be to get a discount at the movies? I think that's 55.
55. And that's so young.
Not quite the same as collecting Social Security, but hey.
Right, no.
Discount of the movies.
But the thing is, right, but it's so interesting because 55 to me seems so young now. I mean, you're not ready to retire. Come on. And if you're going to live to 100, you better have saved up a lot of freaking money.
Halfway through.
Listen, my ex-husband said
to
me.
That's midlife.
Yeah, really. Used to be 30 or 40. Now it's, you know, 55. You could live to 110. It's not out of the question. And my ex-husband said to me the other day that he was on target to retire at 60.
Wow.
And,
that's
great. And he's going to be, I think he turned 54 a couple of days ago. And, I was like, wow. Yeah, I said, I'm not anywhere near that, so good for you. I know who I can come borrow money from, though I don't think his current wife would really like that. But, you know, that's even 60. If he retires at 60 and lives to 100, that's 40 years of doing nothing.
Well, you know, most people don't do anything. I have a buddy. He is 72, and he has the body of a 35-year-old, and he continues to work to this day.
Yeah.
So it's that mindset, wanting to continue to be involved in something, to do something.
Right. And I'm getting back to the story that brought this up, that part-time and entrepreneurial, and all of those kinds of things. I think, you know, that's perfect for people in their 60s and 70s and 80s, frankly, who are capable and want to continue to work. So it's kind of, my stepfather actually is 82 or 83 and owns a company and still goes into work most days. You know, I mean, he has enough of a support staff that he can delegate to that he doesn't have to be there 8 hours a day every day. But he works. He is on top of it.
Well, you know, working keeps them alive.
Absolutely.
That's
what they say. Yeah.
Well, my father retired way too soon and he's bored. And that in turn has sort of made him depressed. And, you know, compared to my stepfather, who's still working and very vibrant. So it is an interesting dilemma, and I think we'll see as the years go on, I think we're going to see more and more part-time and freelance and contract and all that kind
right.
of stuff.
Right. Well, I think the current wave of retirees is a combination of desire and also necessity that's going to make them continue to stay in the workforce well past maybe the previous generation's projected retirement age. And that will likely then create a trend that will continue so that, you know, my generation and now then the younger folks are also working well into their 70s and 80s.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's going to be interesting to kind of see how it all shakes out because you're right. Also, the whole idea of retiring and what that looks like is changing. People don't want to sit around and do nothing.
No, they don't. I played tennis with a lady this past Sunday. She had to be 65 years of age, and I just watched her move around that court like she was awesome.
Like it was nothing.
Yeah. Like nothing.
Yeah. I can't even do that, so bless her heart. All right, moving on. I love my lists. So today for our – I don't even know how many were on this original list, but Atlanta is supposedly – I love lists that are future predicting because how do they really know? But what they're saying is Atlanta is going to be the number 33 most competitive city in the world by the year 2025, which is pretty good. And not only that, I think for people who want to try to get their heads around that a little bit more, we are supposedly going to be number 9 in the country by 2025, 9th most competitive city in the country by 2025, which is pretty amazing when you think about the big cities in this country.
So when you talk about competitive, what area? Or
there was a study done, of course. All these things are from these surveys and studies.
But this is a real study. You know, The Economist did this one. So this is actually fairly factual sometimes.
Are you critiquing?
Our lists come from.
Right. Some of them are kind of somebody's blog just decided that whatever. But in this case, the study looked at 8 categories of competitiveness and 32 individual indicators. The categories included things like economic strength, physical capital, financial maturity, institutional character, human capital, global appeal, social and cultural character, and environmental and natural hazards. And so then they were ranked and indexed and all this kind of stuff. So just FYI, when you look at the world and in 2025, what they're saying is the 10 most competitive cities, the top 10.
I'm really surprised by this because they've got New York and London at the top. And
right.
I think that by 2025, that will have shifted. And
really?
And Singapore and Hong Kong will be at the top.
So Singapore and Hong Kong are number 3 and 4. And so you think they're going to switch. So Elizabeth, a bold statement on the radio saying, so we're going to have to check back in 2025 and see who's right, you or The Economist.
So where is Atlanta currently? today, you know, as of today?
That's a good question, and I don't know the answer to that. But I think the point is that we're moving up.
Okay.
Because,
which is good news for our sponsors. They're investing in the right things. I mean, this shows that, like, Central Atlanta Progress and World Trade Center, they're investing in the right things that are making our city more globally competitive in
right.
the future.
I think they did the same study last year, and I think it was still looking at 2025, but they keep kind of reevaluating, and we moved up 9 spots from where we were.
Excellent.
So the cities in the top 10 in this study worldwide were New York, London, Singapore, Hong Kong, Tokyo, Sydney, Paris, Stockholm, Chicago, and Toronto. So,
like, where are Shanghai and Beijing? Like,
they're maybe they're 11 and 12. Yeah, you never know. There's a lot of cities in the world.
I know.
You know. So, and when it's done like this, where it's a study and each thing is ranked, you know, it's a mathematical thing at the end of the day, how they fall out. And it's, but to some extent, it's all subjective because, you know, ranking something for social and cultural, whatever, yeah, you know, that's
it
somebody's opinion.
Subjective.
Sure. All right. We talked about the Ferris wheel last week, the Atlanta Ferris wheel. Did you hear about that, LaGalia?
No, I did not.
We're getting a huge Ferris wheel in downtown Atlanta.
A Ferris wheel?
Yeah, kind of like the London Eye sort of thing, like a tourist attraction.
20 stories high.
Wow.
So you'll go up in it and you'll see the whole skyline of Atlanta and all of that.
That's going to be nice.
Yeah, and so I wanted to circle back because sometimes I do these stories about, you know, high-speed rail between here and the coast or whatever, and Elizabeth's like, that's never going to come true. I'm like, yeah, but someone talked about it and it was in the newspaper, so I'm allowed to talk about it. But the Ferris wheel, not only is it coming true, it's coming true really soon. So soon, in fact, that the job fair to staff it is today.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So if you're interested
Speaking of part-time work.
Correct. If you're interested
in... looking to fill a gap in your current schedule and you'd like to work the Ferris wheel.
Yeah. So the actual job fair is today. It's started at 9 a.m. So you're only 30 minutes late. No, I'm just kidding. It's actually going all day from 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. at the Omni here in downtown Atlanta. There are full-time and part-time jobs available. Most are paying between $9 and $13 an hour. The jobs include things like wheel operator, loader, unloader, ticket seller, greeter. I'd like to be a greeter.
Oh, you'd
welcome
be great
to the Ferris wheel.
You'd be great as a greeter.
You know, when I'm like 75, 80, well, let me switch that. When I'm like 95, I'll be at Walmart. Welcome to Walmart. And we talked about the ticket price, and I want to, like, eat my shirt on this one because I was all up in how expensive it was going to be last week without knowing. I was guessing because all tourist attractions generally are overpriced. But listen to this. It's going to be the least expensive sort of tourist attraction in downtown Atlanta. Tickets are going to be $13.50 for adults and $8.50 for kids.
That's very reasonable.
Very reasonable. And they'll also have discount tickets for seniors, military, and large groups. So pretty cool. There you go. You'll go around. Here, details. Riders will go around in 42, I'm sorry, 6-person air-conditioned gondolas, just like the London Eye. Very cool. And I'm going in this one. There will be a VIP gondola with all leather seating, a TV monitor, and a champagne and wine bucket with nothing in it, but it'll be there. And then they call them
12 to 15 minute rides. Can you drink a bottle of champagne in 12 to 15 minutes, Dana?
No, especially not going around in a circle. I would be puking my guts up. Just saying. Not going to happen. Last but not least in today's news stories, this always intrigues me, and I don't have a full list here for you, but once a year, 24/7 Wall Street predicts which brands it thinks will disappear in the coming year. And it's not always right. I mean, they sometimes make predictions and the brands will live on. But this year, the predictions for 2014 include Mitsubishi Motors, the WNBA, Olympus, the camera company, Volvo, which surprised me, JCPenney, which has been struggling mightily, and Living Social, just to name a few. And I just want to talk about that for a second because when you think about some of these brands have been around since I can remember. Speaking of loving your car, my mom's owned multiple Volvos. She owns one right now. She loves that thing.
It'll be around. People view it as a very safe vehicle.
I know. But apparently it has such a small market share anymore, believe it or not, that they're predicting it might actually go away. Now, it won't totally go away worldwide, but it will go away from the U.S.
Okay. That was the most shocking one for me.
Me too.
JCPenney, you could see that coming. I mean, they're ripe for acquisition at this point.
Yeah, JCPenney has been struggling for the last couple of years.
They've been coming out with strong marketing campaigns.
Trying to reinvent and rebrand. And they look good.
It almost makes me want to go to JCPenney.
Same here. And I never went there before. Yeah. So it's like they're trying to appeal to somebody different. Because I see the ads and I'm like, oh, that's
now,
a cute dress.
Now, if they have Kmart on there, I would believe that.
Yeah.
Before JCPenney.
I agree with you. Yeah, we're on the same page with that one. But it is kind of interesting. It'll be interesting to see if their predictions are right. And also, I was reading the article, and I don't have it in front of me right now, though I think Elizabeth does. But some of the predictions from last year, I was like, oh, did that brand actually go away? I didn't even know. And I forget what they were now, but I remember seeing some of the ones from last year, and they were saying, well, we got this one right. And I was like, oh, really? That brand is gone? I didn't even know. I had no idea.
And that's funny because there's like a residual brand equity. I mean, if the brand gets faded out too soon, you actually lose out on all of that built up.
If Volvo goes away, what will actually happen? It's not like all the Volvos are going to magically poof and disappear off the roads. So the dealerships, I guess, would be gone, or they would change over to something else. So unless you live near a dealership or drove past one every day on your route to work, you probably wouldn't notice until you went to look to buy one or something, you know, or someone told you, because I wouldn't know. I don't drive past car dealers on my route to work every day. So I would have no idea.
You know, but as I think about it, I don't see many Volvo dealerships at all.
See? I think it might actually be real.
Yeah.
Kind of amazing. Well, we'll come back and check that story out next year at this time, too, and see which of these brands are still. I'm making a lot of promises here today.
Sure are.
I know. What has gotten into me? I have no idea. Well, the good news is I plan to still be alive and kicking next year at this time. Right?
That's the good news.
Another year, right? Another day, another dollar.
Not even close to retirement.
Sad but true. Because I'm telling you, I could have some fun in a beach town, bicycle, sand, surf.
Working a part-time job at the Ferris wheel?
Dude.
Hook me up.
Yeah, but somewhere not here. I mean, no offense. I love Atlanta. But if I am going to ever retire, I don't want to just be where I was. I want to go somewhere exotic. And I want to go to Jamaica or, you know, somewhere cool. And by cool, I mean hot. Okay. Let's move on and talk about some property taxes with our buddy Legalia, who's happily putting up with us this morning. Property taxes, death and taxes, Elizabeth said it best. Two things you cannot escape unless you have Legalia Appleby on your team.
That's right.
So let's talk about this. And let's start by talking about how you got involved in all of this. Give us a little bit of your background and how you even found this niche.
Well, you know, back in 2008, I started investing in real estate property. And what I found was that when I went to pay my taxes, they were astronomical, and I couldn't believe it. I had a buddy who was an investor, had been an investor for over 20 years, and he had about 30 properties. So I appealed both his properties and my properties, and I had a 100% success rate. And so coincidentally, in 2009, I was released from my job.
I love that term. Love it.
And so that's where the niche began. I started appealing other investors' properties. And again, I was very successful. And that's how I started the business.
So how did you kind of figure out the process initially? Did you make mistakes the first couple times? Did you do things you didn't need to? Or?
Well, you know, I am very analytical and I'm very research oriented. And what I initially did was I would go and sit in on existing hearings just to see what the process was, what the people were doing. And so that's how I started. I would meet with some of the chief appraisers or the county appraisers and other officials within the counties and learn from that as well. And I'd start taking some of their classes so that I would know how they think and how to do their job. And so that's how I got my start.
So your taxes are based on the appraised property value or the fair market value.
Correct.
Of the property. That's what they call it. Fair market value.
Fair market value.
Since property values have changed a lot recently,
right,
are there situations where that, you know, appraised fair market value might not be the most accurate actual fair
many,
market
many,
value?
Many, many, many times. The county may have it wrong, but I mean, they do an excellent job for the most part. But because they're doing mass appraisals, they're going to miss many properties in terms of getting the fair market value to that particular property owner. And so that's where I come in at. When you don't get the fair market value, I will represent you before the county to get that fair market value.
Well, I think that proves my earlier point. I mean, most people aren't going to take the time or don't have the time or don't want to spend the time doing what you did to learn all that stuff, taking classes that the appraisers are taking, sitting in appeals to hear what other people are doing. I mean, that's a lot of work. So that's the whole point. I mean, bringing in an expert, you in this case, they're getting the benefit of all those hours you already put in.
They are definitely getting that benefit. And it can be quite time consuming because it can be a very bureaucratic system.
Another great point. Who likes dealing with the government? Raise your hand out there and don't crash your car, but raise your hand. Anybody? Anybody? I don't think so.
Oh, it can be very, very, very painful. I mean, it was painful for me, but I've learned how to navigate the system. And I built relationships in the various counties. So it makes it easier for me to assist my clients in getting the fair market value for their properties.
Yeah. And so let's talk a little bit about what that looks like in terms of savings for somebody. Let's just talk about maybe an individual with a home. Go ahead.
We can talk about my home.
Okay.
I started off, my property was valued at, say, $225,000. When I did the initial appeal, brought it down to about $175,000. But the market continued to decline because of all the foreclosures or distressed properties. So that was back in 2009 that I first did that appeal on my own primary property. Now today, from $208,000 or $225,000, my property is now valued at $86,000.
Oh my gosh.
But I was paying $2,400 in property taxes. I now pay $600.
Wow.
So that's a big saving.
So people, are you listening to that? Huge savings.
Huge, huge savings.
Now let's talk about something that I think might scare some people. If you get your fair market value down that low, does that impact what you can sell your home for? How does that impact the actual value of your home?
Well, it is slightly correlated to it because when they determine the fair market value, they're actually looking at comparable sales in your neighborhood. So that's what your property is likely to go for. However, the market is actually changing as of first and second quarter of this year. Prior to this year, it was pretty distressed. But now, when you put your home up for sale, you're likely to get multiple offers.
Yeah.
Not just one or two. I'm talking about 10 to 15 offers. And some of those offers will actually be above the list price.
It's kind of interesting. I mean, I know it's a little bit of a side note from the property tax discussion, but I think it's kind of interesting because it's almost like what's happened in the inventory is that buyers are starting to get a little more confidence. They're starting to have a little bit more money. Maybe they got a job now. They didn't have one for a while or whatever. And they're ready to start looking and buy. But sellers are still nervous or holding out because maybe the value isn't what they want. You know, when they originally bought the house, they thought they'd make X and they're still not up to X. So
exactly.
They're still holding out. So there's sort of less inventory right now in the good neighborhoods, in the good buildings, all of those kinds of things.
There's very, very little inventory. I was at a recent Keller Williams seminar, and there are probably about 2,000 homes for sale in Metro Atlanta. That's very, very, very low.
Yeah.
Extraordinarily low. So you have an influx of people looking for properties, but they don't have any properties to sell them.
And you think about that, Elizabeth, some of the stories we do hear about XYZ company coming to town and creating 275 jobs. And we do stories like that on a regular basis.
Suddenly like 10% of the house.
Right. Yeah. Right. I mean, and like I'm saying, we do those stories every other week. There's somebody coming and adding 150 jobs, 275 jobs, 1,000 jobs. And then how do these people buy homes?
You know, what happened to the Atlanta market was that a lot of hedge fund investors came in and purchased significant quantities of properties. And they're still doing that. Every Tuesday of the first month, they are at the courthouse steps buying them in groves.
Yeah.
So they've gobbled up all of our properties.
Wow.
For the most part.
It's so interesting.
And so they're also, but it's a good thing in the sense that by them doing that, they're buying them at a higher price point than the average investor on the courthouse steps. So by them, that way, now the prices are escalating.
Okay. So that's good for sellers.
It's good for sellers, but as those prices escalate, so will your taxes.
Right.
So, but this is a prime year. 2013 is the best year ever to do an appeal on your property taxes because they're low and we can lock them in for 3 years while the market increases.
And you did mention to me, I think before the show, that there's a deadline of some kind too,
right? There's a deadline. There's only a small window of opportunity. And it varies from county to county, but from the day you get that appeal notice, and it has a date on there. For instance, Gwinnett County, they sent out their notices back in April. The deadline was May 20th. So there's a 45-day window of opportunity. I spoke to the chief appraiser yesterday for Fulton County. They have not sent their notices out. They're scheduled to go out on June 15th, and that 45-day window would put the property owner at July 31st to file an appeal.
And that's Fulton?
That's Fulton County.
Okay.
DeKalb County, the deadline is...
I just got mine.
Right, you just got it.
I should have brought it today.
I know.
For you.
Yeah.
I'll fax it to you later.
All right, good, excellent.
Wait, so are you DeKalb?
DeKalb.
Yeah, me too now. So, and I think we might actually...
Yeah.
Because we bought a house that I think we're... And so here's another question. If the house is assessed at a certain value, but you got a really good deal because it was a short sale or because whatever, it was bank owned or mm-hmm. the person just gave you a good deal, does that affect the property tax value?
It does. There's a new law effective January 2011. Which indicates or stated that whatever you purchase your property for, the following year is the highest that the county could value it for. So if you purchased a property for $200,000 and you got a good deal on it, say in the neighborhood, your neighborhood, the properties were selling for $400,000 and you picked it up for $200,000.
Yeah.
Then the following year, the county could only assess it no greater than that $200,000 value.
Okay.
And so that's why I say if you bought a property at a low value, you want to lock in that low value for an additional 2 years through the appeal process.
Now, I remember, you know, looking at my tax bill years ago, many years ago, from an older property, and they always seemed like they were lower than what I paid or what the neighborhood was going for. Isn't that sort of typical? Shouldn't it be lower than the actual? Or am I just making that up? Somehow fair market value always seemed to me like it was lower than what I paid.
No, it is basically dictated by what's happening in your community or your neighborhood.
Okay.
Besides looking at comparable sales, they look at uniformity.
I thought they were just being nice and like giving me a little break.
No.
No, they were telling me house was crap is really what you're saying. Okay.
No.
Okay, good to know. Luckily, I sold that one. Have moved on.
Okay.
Now, for a business or a commercial property, is the process similar?
The process is pretty much exactly the same, but there are
Talking about bigger dollars here.
You're talking about bigger dollars. I recently did one on Piedmont. The property was valued at $1.1 million, but we got it down to $750,000. Well, that meant for that client, the first year in savings was $7,000, and because we get the value frozen for 3 years, you're looking at a $21,000 savings for that commercial client.
And when you're, huge. Counting your pennies in business, which everyone does,
it makes a huge difference.
Huge. Well, and we've talked many times over the past few months about Dante's down the hatch going out of business because of their property tax bill.
Oh yeah.
I don't know if that one could have ever been brought back to an amount that would have been fair for him. There's just,
Well, I mentioned that there are several approaches, and one of them is the income approach. Apparently, possibly, maybe he wasn't generating enough income.
Right.
And that could have been used as an indicator.
As a justification for a lower property value.
Exactly.
Interesting. Yeah. It would have been, I have to assume he went through as much as he could have to try to resolve that. I mean, he was sitting there for 30 plus years, right, Elizabeth? Was it something like that he was there? And the Buckhead just built up around him, like huge, expensive high rises. And he's got this little, two-story little building with these huge towers that were worth millions and millions of dollars everywhere around him. So
I guess, in that particular case, what the county was saying was that, hey, given that these huge buildings are building up around you, this land is valued for a whole lot.
Right.
Your building may not be valued at anything,
right,
but the land is.
Right.
And so if he were to sell it, he'd get a huge amount possibly for that land.
I think he did. And the bottom line for the county is, hey, we want that revenue.
Exactly.
We appreciate you. We're happy that you were there all those years, but not that much, because we really want that revenue we can get from a better client.
Well, no. It's not that they want the revenue. They're going to try to do it as fairly as possible. But a lot of times they neglect to do that.
Yeah.
They do.
Well, as you said, when they're doing it, it's not like they singled you out and they're trying to get you. They're not like, hey, Dana Barrett, we don't like you. We're going to overcharge you. They're doing it on a mass scale for every home and every commercial property in their county.
Right.
And somebody's going to get lost in the shuffle. And with the dramatic changes in the economy from, over the last several years, it's inevitable.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I think over the last, 8 to 10 years, we've witnessed probably the most dramatic swing in property values in terms of really high to really low, and now just kind of coming back to like a middle ground.
Well, I wouldn't say they've come back to a middle ground yet. They're modestly increasing, very modestly. In some neighborhoods, that ground was not lost, but in many neighborhoods, you saw 50 to 75% reduction in value.
Yeah.
And that hurt the counties tremendously in terms of revenue, but it is what it is.
Yeah.
That's how it works.
One of the things that people, I think, shy away from hiring an expert is because all of a sudden they hear, I'm going to pay a lot of money if I hire an expert, and that's going to, I can't be bothered. A, I don't know who to trust. B, I don't want to spend the money. But you have an interesting model in terms of how you charge. So explain a little bit about that.
Okay, what we do, there's an initial small fee. Typically, it's between $100 and $150 per property. However, if you have several properties, then it is reduced further. There are more discounts. But we are a performance-based company. So we gain or earn our money on the back end based on our performance. It's based on, say, 30 to 40% of what we save you the first year. For instance, I mentioned that client earlier who we saved $7,000. But effectively, we've saved him $21,000 over a three-year period, and we only earned less than $3,000 on that.
Right. So that's a great investment for him. He saved $21,000. It cost him $3,000 to do it. I mean, that's good math. Even I, who stink at math, can understand the benefit of doing that.
And he had to do absolutely nothing.
Right.
Just sign the agreement form.
And you also...
So you don't have to show up at the courthouse
nothing.
Navigate the system, deal with any of that.
They didn't have to do anything. They just had to just receive their refund check in the mail.
Right, and then write one to you.
Exactly.
Done and done. But also, you even say you're not going to take that, even that small $100 or $150 from somebody without a little bit of an initial assessment to make sure that there's even a reason to take the case.
Right. We have like a 98% success rate, and one of the reasons our success rate is so high is because we first determine if the property warrants a property tax reduction. And if it doesn't, there's no need in us moving forward, wasting your time, because we don't do that. Our goal is to save you time and save you money in this process.
Yeah, I like the model a lot, because first of all, you're just like an upfront person who's saying like, I'm not going to waste my time for $100, $150. If I can't help you, I don't want your $150. I'd rather have a good relationship with you for your next property. And also, getting that $100, $150 out of them they put a little skin in the game, which I like.
Yeah, just a little skin.
A little skin in the game, I think, for any small business, you always have that balance between how much do I give away and how much do I ask for up front and all that kind of stuff. I think people need a little skin in the game to be serious about whatever it is, because you do need them to do some things. They're going to have to give you some documentation. They're going to have to take your phone calls, maybe respond to an email or two, right?
Yeah, and it's very little involvement from the client's part, because we utilize the county records. We utilize our existing systems to pull up data. So they're virtually uninvolved in the process.
Yeah.
Unless, we need some additional information regarding, did they do an improvement on the home, or is there a leak in the roof? Anything that might impact the value.
Interesting. Well, I like that model. I think it's really good. And I think most people, are probably willing to throw out that original $100, $150 thinking they might get to save.
It's a huge savings, especially compared to some of our competitors. Some of them charge as much as $300 just to go through the process, and they may not do an initial consultation as we do. And our initial consultation, again, is free.
Yeah.
So, where can we find you, LaGaylia?
The most important thing. What's your contact
Before
info?
Dana cuts us off, yeah. Let's make sure we get the contact information out there. Because like you said, this is a deadline that, if people are listening to this and thinking, wow, this sounds like something I'd like to investigate, they should jump on it.
Exactly. They can contact us via phone, 678-971-3118. Again, 678-971-3118. 3118, or they can go directly to our website, appealgeorgiapropertytax.org. That's appealgeapropertytax.org.
That's easy enough. I think people can remember that. And again, something I would never have thought of, but I love the fact that I could end up with like $7,000 extra a year to go shopping.
Oh, yeah. That's
a lot of shoes, girl. It's a lot of haircuts. It's a lot of shoes. I'm just saying.
A lot of purses.
A lot of, yeah.
A trip to Jamaica.
That's right. Sun and surf.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think it is one of those things. Who doesn't love to save money, you know, especially on something that you're spending needlessly?
And it becomes a win-win situation because you win at the end. We are saving you money and we're saving you time.
Yeah. Now, what happens after that three-year period? Do you have to start all over?
You pretty much start all over because the market conditions have changed.
Yeah.
So you would be starting all over.
So it's a three-year cycle that you're evaluating.
Three-year cycle, typically. I mean, however, you know, there's some instances. For instance, for my home, I appealed every year because although I got a reduction every year, I continue to appeal every year because the economy or the property.
So when the market's going down, it's
you want to keep appealing,
it every year.
Right?
Interesting. It's really fascinating. I'm so glad that there are like somebody's out there being a watchdog on this because, like I said, I mean, there are so many people that are just too busy, don't think about it. It's sort of you just think you have to pay what's on the bill and you just don't even realize you have an option.
Yeah, there are options. And you don't want to go through the process. It can take from 6 months to 18 months in some counties to complete the process.
Yeah.
So you don't want to have to do that.
Well, and you mentioned before, too, I think there's a lot of people out there, you know, great individual homeowners definitely want to take a look at their bill for sure. But there's a lot of people out there like yourself that are real estate investors or they own commercial properties. And all of those people can go through this process.
Oh, anyone who owns a property, whether it is a home, a commercial building or a vacant lot. We recently did a vacant lot where the county had it valued at $160,000. Through our process, we got it down to $9,600. That was a huge savings for that client.
Oh, huge. My goodness. Amazing.
It's amazing that the county neglected to fairly value that property.
Wow. Amazing. All right. So one more time, the website is?
AppealGeorgiaPropertyTax.org.
Awesome. Great conversation, LaGalia Appleby. Thank you so much for being here with us. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
And Elizabeth, any thoughts from you?
Another great show, Dana. Thanks for keeping it real.
We try to do what we do here.
All the best of the ATL.
Elizabeth, are you... we like to overshare.
Actually, I will give a little shout out to an event I've got going on.
Please.
Tomorrow, Thursday evening at Cose here in downtown, the Power and Pink Stripes. I'm on a panel with a number of very fabulous chic entrepreneurs here in the city. So you can still get tickets to that event if you Google it.
Very exciting. All right. Well, we're giving shout outs. I will also say, so that was Power and Pink Stripes.
Power and Pink Stripes.
And yes, the fabulous Elizabeth Gordon will be speaking on the panel. And while we're giving shout outs, I will also mention that Business Radio X is about to form a partnership with Biz 1190 AM. And I will be hosting a show on Sundays, probably starting late June, early July, on Sundays at noon on Biz 1190 AM. So if you like this show, you'll love that one. But that's our show for today. And again, thanks to LaGalia Appleby for joining us and always to our sponsor, World Trade Center Atlanta. You can learn more about World Trade Center Atlanta by visiting their website, which is WTCAtlanta.com. I'm Dana Barrett.
And I'm Elizabeth Gordon. You've been listening to Business Radio X, a proud 2013 member of Central Atlanta Progress. Learn more about Central Atlanta Progress at AtlantaDowntown.com. We will talk to you next week.